Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for this morning is State of Michigan, etc., against the United States Army Corps of Engineers, number 103891. Mr. Reichel.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Robert Reichel, Assistant Attorney General for the State of Michigan, appearing to present argument on behalf of all the plaintiff appellant states, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. As the Court is aware, this is an interlocutory appeal from a December 2010 order by the District Court for the Northern District of Illinois, denying, in its entirety, a motion for preliminary injunction. Let me emphasize at the outset that the states recognize that a preliminary injunction, particularly a mandatory preliminary injunction, is indeed an extraordinary remedy. And we also recognize that a district court's exercise of discretion in dealing with such a motion is rarely subject to being disturbed on appeal. Nonetheless, we submit that on the record before this court, this is a truly exceptional case, one that warranted the extraordinary relief of a preliminary injunction below and warrants reversal by this court.
So I wonder if you could begin by clarifying exactly what, in your perfect world, this preliminary injunction would say. Because it seems to me, reading through all of these materials, that the states have changed their position from time to time. And I'll just tell you, for me, it's not clear to what extent any such injunction would have an exception for flooding situations, would have an exception for public safety, maybe not at all, maybe yes, but if you could just clarify what you are really asking for, that would be helpful.
I'd be happy to do so, Judge Wood. Again, there are basically two prongs to the preliminary injunction that the state sought. The first prong was a series of measures requesting that the court enjoin the principal defendants, the Corps of Engineers and the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District, to take a series of measures, to interim measures, in addition to what's happening now, to physically impede the movement of additional Asian carp through the waterway into the lake.
Okay, so you say in addition to what's happening now, because I'm sure you would agree that lots of things are happening now. So it's your view that these additional measures would have enough of a marginal improvement in the ultimate goal of keeping the carp away from the lakes, that they're worth the cost.
Absolutely.
And how clear is the record on how effective these additional measures would be?
Well,
And I would find it helpful as well for you to tick off the additional measures.
Yes.
You know, so we can know for sure what you're
Absolutely.
Asking for now.
And going back to Judge Wood's original
yeah.
question. So on the first prong, which again deals with interim physical mm-hmm. measures, those include placing physical barriers where they do not already exist in sluice gates, which are openings in water control structures at the Chicago Lock River Controlling Works and at the O'Brien Lock and Dam.
So like the two sluice gates that are already there, except across all eight of the gates at the Chicago facility and then the four at the O'Brien?
That's correct. The object being that whenever those gates are open, that there be in place screens that would impede the passage of fish, because those sluice gates are used as water control mechanisms, some routinely for allowing water from the lake into the waterway, other times in unusual events for reversing the flow under flood conditions. So that's one specific measure. In addition,
does the record show that the Corps is using the gates that are not already protected? And there are sluice gates there are gates over two of them, as I understand, that are along the lines of what you're looking for.
Right. Well, the record reflects that the Corps and the district have installed sluice gates in a total of four of the, screens in a total of four of the sluice gates. But the stated practice is to, there are occasions, particularly under high water flow events. They don't occur often, but there are occasions where, to avert flooding, the local authority, the district, finds it necessary to ask that the other additional sluice gates be opened to reverse the flow. And the stated position of both the Corps and the district is that in such a reversal, they would remove the screens where they are already installed and would not have any sort of screen whatsoever in these additional gates that are open from time to time. But let, if I may, let me go back to just give you a quick summary of the additional measures. Again, basically, in essence, what we are asking, we ask the district court to order
just,
what...
Just to clarify, on the screens, you want screens everywhere that are never removed, no matter how bad the flooding is or whatever other reason. You want screens just welded in somehow.
Well, and again, what we ask the district court ultimately to do is to enter an order requiring the defendants to come up with a plan for installing screens. A concern was raised that under certain circumstances, screens can become blocked with debris.
Right.
And that could impede their function in relieving flood pressure.
Right.
So we indicated that this plan should build into it one or more mechanisms to alleviate that concern. And we suggested two things. The primary thing is using existing technology that is applied at other situations, devices that automatically remove debris from the screens, rakes.
Right, yeah.
And we also indicated that, again, consistent with our position that the plaintiff states are not seeking to increase the flooding risk to the citizens of the Chicago region, if it were the case that these screens became clogged, under our proposed injunction of the plan that we would ask the court to approve, if necessary, the screens could be removed under those conditions. But the goal is, or the stated performance objective, is to use the available technology, such as it exists, to, whenever it's feasible to do so, keep these screens in place so as to reduce the risk. Let me move on from the screens, if I may, because there are other components, as the court is aware. One of the other components of the interim relief we sought, and undoubtedly the most controversial, is the request that the Chicago and O'Brien locks, temporarily at least, be closed, except as necessary to protect public health, safety, and welfare. And in that regard, the principal concern that we are trying to address there, or we believe that should be incorporated in such an injunctive order, is the possibility that under certain high water flow events, it's necessary. It doesn't happen often, but it's occasionally necessary to open not only the sluice gates, but to open the locks to avert flooding. And I want to be clear about this. There may have been some confusion, but we tried to make it very clear when we presented our final argument to the district court in the post-hearing argument on October 18th. What we were not suggesting that the court become involved in micromanaging the operation of these locks. Our specific request was that the order provide that the locks be closed temporarily, except in those circumstances, as they exist today, where the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District, which routinely monitors rainfall and precipitation events, monitors the elevations of water in the waterway, they make the call as to when the locks need to be opened.
Well, I mean, I'm glad you mentioned the micromanaging issue, because I'll be very frank with you, that is a big concern of mine anyway. Because there's squishiness in a lot of these things you're proposing. You know, the screens need to be down unless it's so serious that maybe they might even have to be removed if there's too much debris. You can imagine in a large storm, lots of tree branches come down, leaves, et cetera, lots of debris. So that. Or maybe the locks are closed unless it's a huge emergency. And I'm acutely aware, having waded through as much of this record as I was able to do in time for this argument, that these are extraordinarily complicated trade-offs that are being made. And you're quite right to recognize that there are trade-offs. You want the balance more toward protection, and I understand that. So my first concern really is this micromanaging and being sure that the improvements that you're talking about are enough to make it worth it. The second thing, I'll be very frank with you, that, you know, in your brief, I was a little surprised at the number of times the state said things like, oh, well, so it's a few more bulkheads, that's just a cost. Well, this is just a matter of money. You know, we don't know where the money's coming from. I was sitting there thinking, goodness gracious, a congressman from one of the plaintiff states is one of the leaders in the effort to reduce the federal budget. I don't know where this money is coming from, and to say that, oh, it's just a matter of money is a little disturbing. I mean, courts don't usually go around ordering money to be spent.
Understood, and we do not intend to be in any way flippant about it, but let me try to address that part of the concern. The fact of the matter is that, as the defendants note, a considerable effort is being undertaken as we speak, a variety under this Asian curve control strategy framework that has been described in the record below, and detailed involving the expenditure of tens of millions of dollars for a variety of projects, many of them devoted to researching possible future solutions.
Right, this GLMRIS program and so on. Why aren't the carp going to just swim in through Lake Erie or Minnesota or through Burns Harbor or through any of these other pathways that they have?
Why are the carp going to swim in?
Why won't they swim in? I mean, you're focusing on the Chicago lock, the Chicago River Controlling Works, and the O'Brien Lock and Dam. But if you look at a map that the Corps of Engineers has, they're actually, it looks to me like, 18 different pathways that the carp have all around the Great Lakes.
May I address that, Judge?
Yeah.
Okay. The focus of this litigation is the Chicago area waterway system. There are five separate points of direct water connection between the Chicago area waterway, which is the focus of this litigation, and Lake Michigan. Our request for preliminary injunctive relief, the first prong, is addressed to using whatever means are available to physically impede the passage of fish through each of those, mm-hmm. so we can tick through them. There's a Wilmette pumping station.
Right.
There are sluice gates there.
Map, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
So we are asking that that barriers be placed there. We are asking that, as we've discussed with respect to the Chicago and O'Brien locks, that the operation of the locks be limited and that screens, physical barriers be placed in sluice gates. With respect to the Grand Calumet River, as it happens, there is in place today, for other independent reasons, because of a dredging project, a cofferdam, a physical barrier placed in that pathway, which, as an interim measure, provides some relief. There's a fifth pathway, the Little Calumet River, where there is no existing control structure, nothing is being done. And that is why another element of our preliminary injunctive relief under the first prong was asking that, as an interim measure, that a physical barrier or barriers be placed that are block nets, which are, as the name implies, nets that are used by fisheries people to impede, so they stretch them across a body of water to block the passage of fish, at least fish that can't fit through the size of the net.
But Indiana is not in this case, right?
That's correct. But the suggestion specifically that we made in our papers below was that a logical place to do this would actually be within that stretch of the Little Calumet River on the Illinois side of the border. But in any event, the Corps of Engineers has not disputed their authority to do this. They have simply said they are looking at it. They expressed concerns about the possibility that if these nets became clogged, that might cause flooding. And again, let me go back to your concern about micromanagement, because it's very important that we be clear about this. We are not asking the district court judge to routinely make operational decisions. The form of the injunction that we were seeking was an order requiring the defendants to do certain things. With respect to the lock closure, the order would provide that decisions as to when to close the locks, open the locks for non-navigation purposes, would be made as it is today, precisely as it is today, and that's in the record, which the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District makes the call as to when the flooding is sufficiently severe. We are not proposing to usurp that authority. So that would not be any change. With respect to these other measures, our injunction seeks the development of a plan, which would then be approved with the operational details. For example, with respect to the screens and the sluice gates, raking machines, block nets, etc., so that there would be a plan developed, put in place, and then would be implemented, rather than running to the court on some ad hoc basis seeking to involve it in operational
decisions.
And
let me get back to the whole financial situation, because as I understand this pot of money, and now we have a CARP czar, I mean, you mentioned that a lot of that money is going toward research. A lot of the things here will be very costly. Are the states, or should the states, bear any of the financial burden that would result from these measures you're asking for, and specifically from closing the lock?
Well, the taxpayers of the plaintiff states, of course, ultimately will pay their proportionate share of the whatever these costs are. In terms of the costs of the closing the locks, except for the issue of installing a bulkhead, and I can get to that, that's fairly technical, that is not going to incur costs. The costs of putting in the screens and the sluice gates, I don't mean to downplay this, but we're not talking about staggering sums of money. The record reflects that the screens that were already put in place, the Corps estimated, would cost about $250,000.
Well, the sums of money, I mean, I find the record actually fairly unsatisfactory on both sides in terms of cost, because the states are suggesting that should the CARP get into Lake Michigan, or all the lakes, you know, any lake, the system of the Great Lakes, you know, a $7 billion industry will crumble. And maybe it will, or maybe it won't. Maybe it'll be half of the industry. Maybe it'll be something else. It strikes me as pretty speculative. On the other hand, there's a great deal of commerce that flows through these various points from the lakes into the Mississippi River Basin. And that's a lot of money. Maybe not all in one year. You know, maybe that's being exaggerated, too, for all I know. But when you're talking about preliminary injunctive relief, you really need to ask two questions. And I'm going to say, for the sake of argument, I'm willing to assume that the states have shown that the harm would be irreparable if the CARP, you know, that it's really imminent and so on. The district judge was looking at, like, one dead CARP here and there. But let's just put that to one side, assume you're right about that. But you still have to balance the benefit that you would get from these extra measures against the cost to the parties, plural, against which those measures run. And I don't think that balancing process has happened in as thorough a way as it needs to.
Well, let me address that briefly, Judge. With respect to the $7 billion figure, I want to be clear. The plaintiff state's contention is not that is this, that if Asian carp become established in the Great Lakes ecosystem, there will be very substantial, irreversible disruption of the ecology, the aquatic food chain, the fisheries, the uses of these resources. To try to address, for purposes of preliminary injunction, on an order of magnitude basis, the relative harms at issue here, we have pointed to a widely accepted estimate of the annual economic impact of the Great Lakes fisheries as a whole. We are not necessarily
as a whole for this short preliminary injunction period. That may be a vastly overstated estimate, because even the defendants don't say we've decided not to do anything. We love Asian carp. I mean, they are taking this threat very seriously, it seems to me.
Well, let me be clear. The point that I want to make is that The scientific evidence in the record we submit, viewed in its entirety, shows that the harm will be irreversible. It may take some time to unfold, but the harm, and this is critically important, Your Honors, the harm that we are seeking to avert is the carp establishing a foothold in the ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
We're not suggesting that we will see carp leaping everywhere in the Great Lakes, you know, next week or next month. But the science tells us, and the record indicates, that once they become established, that invasions like this, there's no track record of reversing them. And while it's one of the defendant's witnesses has speculated that maybe we'll come up with some silver bullet or something that can help reverse it, there is no reason to believe that. It is the irreversible nature. The harm is the establishment.
And I totally take that point. And so as I've understood this case, it's really about which methods and which timetables for the prevention of the establishment of that breeding population are going to work. I hate to do this, but I think there's some broader legal issues that we need to reach as well. So before you sit down, I'm just going to say one of the arguments the Corps of Engineers has made is that it's actually not possible to bring a public nuisance lawsuit against the United States. It's a broad claim, and it's related to the claims that the Supreme Court has before it in the American Electric Power litigation. So, you know, in some ways you can understand, if you go back to the history of public nuisance law, public nuisance was an offense against the Crown, and so the Crown wasn't committing offenses against itself. I haven't found, aside from the particular situation of the TVA and federal entities that are in business, examples of public nuisance actions being brought against the United States.
Well, as the court is aware, the United States argued below and continues to argue before this court that the state's claims sounding a nuisance are barred by the doctrine of sovereign immunity. We've addressed that in our brief, and I'd be happy to address that further.
Well, and it's even more than a sovereign immunity. I know they've made that point, and they have their APA arguments as well, but it's really, in a sense, have you stated a claim on which relief can be granted if you're saying that the government, in the set of measures it's chosen to address this serious threat, is itself either creating a public nuisance or is it failing to abate a threatened public nuisance? I'm not sure which is your theory, actually, whether you're saying they're creating the public nuisance or whether you're saying they're just failing to abate it effectively.
Well, our contention is that the federal government, which has participated in the creation of this waterway and the associated infrastructure and bears a large degree of responsibility for how it is operated, including the infrastructure of the locks.
Over more than a century, of course.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Has created and is continuing to contribute to a condition that is as a set of the way the system is currently configured and operated that is causing, or we say there is a significant threat of causing, harm to public rights, which is the essence of a nuisance claim. So it is both the maintenance of the existing, creating these conditions, keeping them in place in the face of this looming threat, and failing to take reasonable measures within their control to further minimize the risk of this harm.
All right, so let me ask how far this theory goes. Suppose in this period of time in which oil prices are becoming extremely high, the federal government decides to issue a license for a new nuclear power plant on Lake Michigan, you know, where they're using the water to cool or something like that. And then some people are afraid that a Fukushima-like disaster is going to happen there. Has the federal government, by licensing the nuclear power plant, created an imminent threat of a public nuisance?
Not necessarily.
So why isn't this more or less the same thing? If the government is acting within the scope of authority given to it by Congress, which the Corps of Engineers throughout has done, people can disagree at a public policy level whether a certain canal should have been built or whether a certain dam should have been, you know, a levee blown up or whatever. We've been listening in the news to that kind of thing. And yet, normally we think that the solution to those disagreements is a political solution. You elect different people, you put in an administration with different priorities, and that's how you solve the problem. You don't go to court and claim a public nuisance.
Well, let me address that briefly. While it is true that the Congress has authorized the Corps to construct and to operate these facilities, that authorization to construct and operate does not insulate the Corps or anyone else from compliance with other laws that exist. So, for example,
what's the law that you are relying? That's what I'm trying to get to the bottom of. Anything except public nuisance?
Well,
or is that it?
Well, there are two claims in our underlying action, two legal claims. There's the common law public nuisance claim, and we are also we've also alleged and sought judicial review of Corps actions under the Administrative Procedures Act. So those
right,
are.
But in the APA claim, you know, to paraphrase, what's the there? I mean, what duty has the Corps of Engineers failed to live up to such that its actions were arbitrary and capricious?
what it has failed, confronted with information from its own experts and scientists that indicate that the measure, that there is an imminent risk of substantial and irreversible environmental harm, it has persisted in continuing essentially routine operation of facilities, and it has, among other things, in trying to evaluate what range of options it would consider, it arbitrarily limited those. For example, in it's this one of the decisions they made.
Right, that I know is, that's your six-part thing where they didn't study just shutting it down, right?
That's one element of it. Those are just by illustrative purposes, Judge.
You don't have, like, a statutory section. This isn't like the Clean Water Act or the Clean Air Act where they had a duty to go out and issue regulations for emissions or whatever. There's no concrete source of this duty.
Well, I think there are some statutory sources that reflect congressional policy, but it's precisely the point you just made, Your Honor, that this is not a situation like the Clean Water Act or Clean Air Act where there exists a comprehensive regulatory framework where Congress has addressed this. That is why we submit common law has not been displaced.
But the theory there has to be that if Congress hasn't spoken to it, there's always an opportunity to get a court to come in and regulate it. And I thought that there was actually a third possibility, which was that it was a political matter.
Well, I'm running into my time here, Your Honor.
I would like to save your time. This is a very complex case, and I
appreciate it. I want to respond to that, Judge, but,
sure.
Just to complete that one thought. The Congress, at least at a broad policy level, has spoken to this issue in a few ways that are relevant to this, and we've noted that in our brief. Those include, among other things, the statute in the Water Resources Development Act of 2007 where they directed the Corps of Engineers to undertake this study of options for separating these two basins or providing a permanent solution that could address Asian carp and other invasive species. And the policy there is preventing the transfer. That's the term. Similarly, under Section 126 of the 2010 Appropriations Act, Congress gave the Corps some authority to take additional measures to prevent the dispersal. So this congressionally stated policy, in the absence of a specific regulatory framework, is we should prevent, or the Corps should prevent, the dispersal of these invasive species. And again, just to complete this last thought, I want to remind the Court, as I'm sure you're well aware, that the second element of our preliminary injunction addressed a distinct issue, that is, our request.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
Let me just
that.
Ask you one other question with respect to these measures, because you've outlined several. Do you rank them, or do you have any priority in terms of, you know, which measures absolutely need to be taken, or is it your position that all need to be taken? I mean, they're all equally important. They would have different impacts. They cover different things, so they all need to be impacted. Or can you say, absolutely, this has to be done? You know, if you have...
Is there a hierarchy?
Exactly.
Judge? Not specifically. The underlying theory... Well, let me say this. That the premise of our request for relief is to take the steps that they can to minimize the likelihood that additional fish get in. And so we look at where those risks exist. There are some places, perhaps the greatest, certainly the issue of lock opening is a high priority because there is more water there, there's more opportunity for the fish to transit. So I can't give you a precise listing, but the operational principle in terms of prioritizing is where, under the existing conditions, is there the greatest risk that these fish can enter the lake? So, for example, the locks would be an obvious priority from that standpoint.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much. All right. Mr. Jay?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The District Court did not abuse its discretion in denying the mandatory preliminary injunction that the plaintiff states sought. It didn't abuse its discretion because the...
Who are you speaking for?
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm William Jay of the Department of Justice, speaking for the Army Corps of Engineers.
That too. Thank you.
I'm sorry. The District Court correctly concluded that the plaintiffs had shown only a minimal likelihood of success on the merits of their claims. that they hadn't shown a likelihood of irreparable injury during the time that it will take this litigation to reach final judgment in the district court, and that the balance of the harms weighs against the mandatory preliminary injunctive relief that the plaintiffs have sought.
Let me ask you, I mean, I find it difficult, given the history of this species, to accept the fact that just because actual carp have only been found in a few places, one alive, one dead, that this is not something that sets out a case for a significant risk of injury. This environmental DNA methodology is a scientifically responsible one that the Corps itself has relied on. You're really, to use maybe an inapt metaphor for a water case, I mean, you're playing with fire. I mean, these things don't need very many fish before a breeding population can establish. And the science seems to suggest that they're happy to eat just about anything, you know, the algae in the lake, if there are no plankton, et cetera. So I think it's kind of a weak position for you to say, oh, what the heck, there isn't much risk. And that feeds into the state's second request. You know, if the Corps doesn't see any sense of urgency, maybe the Corps should tell them to get on the job.
Well, Judge Wood, the federal, state, and local governments are taking a number of actions. They're taking this taking the Asian carp situation extremely seriously. And as was brought out in Mr. Reichel's argument, there's been a large commitment of federal resources to address this problem, both scientifically and in terms of preventive measures. It's the plaintiff's burden in seeking preliminary injunctive relief, however, to show not just that if the carp establish themselves in the Great Lakes, the resulting injury would be irreparable, but that situation is likely to occur during the time it will take this litigation to reach final judgment in the district court.
And for that, I assume that's part of what they would have to show is why the measures already in place, whether they're the electric barriers or whether they're the screens over the existing sluice gates and so on, aren't, even if they're not going to be good forever, why aren't they doing the job? But let me ask you one technical question, which I hope you can answer. In all of the chaos of the appropriations process in March, do you still have this Section 126 authority? Did Congress continue that?
Yes, Judge Wood. The Section 126 authority extends through the end of this fiscal year. Each continuing resolution that Congress has passed for this year has extended the fiscal year 2010 appropriations measures, including the authorities granted thereunder. And so Section 126 lasts until September 30th, 2011, unless extended. And that the use of that authority obviously it has been a major part of the Corps' efforts in this respect. One of those efforts was the rotenone operation, which is a significant factor that the district court took extensive testimony on and understood that after the eDNA results came back, the Corps used those results as the basis for the rotenone operation. And conducted an extensive operation to see if there were any Asian carp in that stretch of the river. And none were found, despite thousands of fish, hundreds of thousands of pounds of fish recovered. And the testimony of Mr. Woolley from the Fish and Wildlife Service was that the service was highly confident that it had recovered every fish from that stretch of the river precisely.
Divers were sent down to check the
bottom. Divers were sent down. Underwater cameras were used. And the service has used at its laboratories rotenone to see if they could replicate the same situation with Asian carp. And if poisoned by rotenone, Asian carp will float to the surface.
That is a practical question, please. How far are the carp in a reproducing population? In what river and how far are they?
Judge Mannion.
They jump around and all the stuff we've seen on television where they jump up and hit people and everything else.
Judge Mannion, the information that I have is that, and I should note that I'm not sure how much of this is in the record, but the information that I have is that the highest spot where young fish have been, or larval fish have been found, is at the Peoria Pool, which is below Starve Rock Dam, I think about 65 river miles below the electric barrier, and that There was some...
Meaning below, before it or after it?
Below the electric barrier, meaning south of, downstream from.
Away from Lake Michigan.
Away from Lake Michigan.
Which direction?
That's what I wondered.
That's
yeah.
right.
The reason I'm asking this, because I'm just wondering if at some point there's kind of a choke point or something, where these fish could be stopped before getting to all these fingers that go into Lake Michigan. And it's like trying to catch a shotgun almost. I just wonder, from a practical standpoint, is there a place somewhere upstream, I'll call it, away from Chicago, that something could be set up that would stop them or kill them or do something in one place so that, and then if that were to be blocked, then subsequent to that towards Chicago, then you can concentrate on killing whatever got through, knowing that the source will no longer be feeding this. It's just because when we look at this, I happen to live next to the St. Joe River in Indiana, which was one of the rivers mentioned that, boy, they'll really thrive there. I can't catch any of the fish that go by, but they are steelhead and salmon and smallmouth bass and all that stuff. So it's just a question is, before it gets all out here, is there a way to stop it early? Because all these things about in Chicago, there's so many things going on. And to try to stop it at every point it seems overwhelming, frankly.
Well, Judge Bannion, before the waterway system diverges into the fingers, as you alluded to, there's the electric barrier. That's one choke point. And I'll come back to that in a second. But even below the electric barrier, closer to the Mississippi, the government undertakes substantial fishing operations to try and reduce the population down there. And the scientific term for that is reducing the propagule pressure. Mr. Chapman of the Geological Survey, who's an expert with 30 years' experience in dealing with Asian carp, explained that you reduce the propagule pressure, meaning that you reduce the species' incentive to keep expanding. So by reducing the population down in the Illinois River or further down the waterway, you reduce the chance that they will seek to challenge the electric barrier. Now, we submit the electric barrier, and the district court found that the electric barrier has not been shown to have failed, contrary to the plaintiff's submission. It's working, and the Corps has invested substantial effort into making sure that it's working at the optimal settings to deter Asian carp, turn them back, and see that they don't get into the Chicago area waterway system.
When you refer to the electric barrier, I thought that there were, at this point, actually a couple of layers, if you will.
There are, Judge Wood. There are redundancies that have now been built in. Congress has directed that they all be considered one project, but they're known as Barrier 1, Barrier 2A, and Barrier 2B, and some can be on, and some, while others are down for maintenance, for example. So there is a redundant increasingly capable barrier system. Barrier 2A and 2B represent an advance over Barrier 1, which was the first demonstration project constructed.
Is it fair to say that at least for the time being, while you're in the midst of this study that isn't going to come out until 2015, the electric barrier is your first-level defense mechanism?
It certainly is one of the most important. It's not the only one. The fishing operations and our monitoring operations in the Chicago area waterway are parts of that. The screening of the locks, and the measures that we've taken to prevent the carp from gaining access to the waterway system through an overland flood from another body of water from the Des Plaines River.
Right.
Those are all steps that we've taken. It's certainly true that the electric barrier is an important part of the defense, and that's why the Corps has and indeed Congress has given great attention to making sure that it knows as much as possible about how to operate it at the optimal settings to deter Asian carp. And there's, as the district court found, there's no evidence that Asian carp have been able to get past the electric barrier. Now, it's certainly true that one live Asian carp was found in the Chicago area waterway system, but as the district court concluded, that doesn't mean that that carp got through the electric barrier. There are a number of ways that carp could have gotten there. And the district court looked at all of that. Dr. Lodge, the plaintiff's expert, acknowledged that in the Chicago area, bighead carp have been found in landlocked lagoons. They certainly didn't swim there from down the waterway system. So there are alternative explanations for how that bighead carp got there. And so the Corps, the other federal agencies, the states and local governments have gone to great lengths to patrol the Chicago area waterway system, to use eDNA as a tool to identify where to target those efforts. They've used extensive and indeed unprecedented netting and electrofishing operations, and they use them in tandem. Mr. Woolley testified that the netting operations used with electrofishing to drive the carp into the nets, that can work.
But some of your, I mean, I can't resist saying, some of the things you're talking about remind me of the efforts that were made to plug the hole in the Chicago River when we had our great downward flood 20-some-odd years ago. And you're talking about an acoustic and bubble curtain. It sounds like, you know, you're going to blast Barry Manilow at them or something, so the carp will say, you know, and they'll all swim back to the Mississippi. So I don't know, but I guess I have two questions I would really like to hear from you on. One of them is why we should not ask the district judge to take another look at the second part of the state's effort to obtain relief and say, you know, maybe you've just got to ratchet up the urgency on this and get this report out before 2015. That's actually quite some time off. So that's the first thing. The second thing, your theory about common law public nuisance against the government is a very ambitious one, which does run into conflict with these cases against the TVA that has a dual role, and it also suggests to me that particularly in an area like this where there doesn't seem to be displacement from a comprehensive federal scheme, it's a little bit different from the American Electric Power case in that respect. But, you know, I'm thinking of examples like the Mineral Management Service down in the Gulf, which was so poorly executing its responsibilities that it allowed essentially an unregulated situation to be there. Now, I know you're saying that's not this case, you guys are all working hard, that's great, you know, and all of that, but that's a factual distinction. It's not a theoretical question about whether one could, in appropriate circumstances, say that the federal government, in the exercise of its regulatory responsibilities, was, in fact, perversely creating a public nuisance. Suppose some, you know, food company wanted to sell lots of Asian carp to China, and they said, we actually would like it if they spread all over the Great Lakes because we'd have so much more to export. And your agency said, oh, that sounds like a good idea. Well, the states might say, no, it's not a good idea. It's going to ruin an ecosystem.
Well, with the court's permission, I'll take the second part of Your Honor's question first. Let me note first about the TVA. TVA has a soon-be-sued clause. TVA can be sued irrespective of these limitations under the Federal Tort Claims Act. And whereas here, that was the situation in FDIC versus Meyer as well, whereas here there is no sue and be sued clause, and because we submit the waiver of sovereign immunity in Section 702 of the APA doesn't apply. The plaintiffs haven't identified an applicable waiver of sovereign immunity for this nuisance claim.
You think it doesn't apply is because of this indirect inference that you draw from the FTCA. And if you look at the legislative history of the APA section, it seems to say we want this to be a waiver of sovereign immunity for any kind of claim, statutory, non-statutory, you name it.
Any kind of claim with the proviso, Judge Wood, as the legislative history reflects, Clause 2 was added at the request of the Department of Justice. Page 13 of the committee report, the committee explained that where there were existing limitations in existing waivers of sovereign immunity, such as the FTCA, that limited plaintiffs to obtaining a particular form of relief, those limitations would not be disturbed by the adoption of Section 702.
But I don't read the FTCA as that kind. What the FTCA is an affirmative waiver of sovereign immunity for tort damages when a private person would be liable under the law of the place for the activity. So, you know, the federal employee runs into somebody with a government car. Okay, a private person would be. This is not such a case. First of all, the whole point of all of the cases from Illinois against Milwaukee 1 and 2 and all the rest of them is that you have federal common law here precisely because no particular state's law can exist. So you're out of the realm of the Federal Tort Claims Act altogether, I think, in this situation. So I think it's just silent. It doesn't say, and the United States will never waive its immunity for injunctive relief. Nothing like that in the statute.
Well, I think 3 points on that, Judge Wood. First, the proviso in Section 702 deals exactly with the situation that Your Honor posited. There's already a partial waiver of sovereign immunity, the FTCA. The Tucker Act is another example, and I think it's illustrative. The United States has waived its sovereign immunity for money damages for breach of contract, but it's established. It's established by the very Spectrum leasing case that the plaintiffs cite and by the legislative history itself, that you can't go under the APA to get injunctive relief on a contract claim because the Tucker Act, like the FTCA, says one form of remedy, damages. Now, the plaintiffs, one can seek damages from the United States for nuisance if one goes under the FTCA. The plaintiffs haven't done that, and they can't do that precisely because under the FTCA, tort claims challenging discretionary judgments of an expert agency cannot be litigated. And it would be extremely unusual. Your Honor alluded to this in colloquy with my friend, that there are no cases applying common law nuisance to a federal agency that is exercising judgment and power delegated to it by Congress and asking federal judges to formulate a rule of decision that supersedes the agency's discretion. When Congress speaks, that is the last word, and federal common law does not federal common law is overridden by statute, not vice versa. And here you have an express statutory direction to the Corps to operate this waterway in the service of navigation from Chicago Harbor to the Mississippi River, and that is exactly what the plaintiffs are seeking to have enjoined under the name of federal common law.
Saying this electric barrier, I guess this is somebody's exhibit anyway, but about the lower Des Plaines River, is that the only source for these fish can come through at that point, for example?
Is that the only source?
The only way the fish can get up towards Lake Michigan?
Well, Your Honor, the Corps has looked at, for example, whether they could be washed over land in a flood or something.
But there may be another circuitous route through Indiana or something, but I'm talking about this source. Is that happen to be one of the choke points? I'm just using that because it's...
The barrier was located there because it would be a choke point.
Okay, because that's really what I'm looking at from a practical standpoint, is if before we get into the maze of fingers, that it would then be a place to block it all by something that maybe they're suggesting, something more... I don't understand this screen, for example, because these fish can jump 10 feet in the air, so it's not exactly how high is the screen. Example. I don't know the logistics of it, but I'm just looking at it from that standpoint, because this seems so frustrating to try to stop it every that many fingers in the dike. It just seems so impractical, frankly.
Well, I think that the judgment that the expert agency has made is that the electric barrier is an important part of combating that, and where other steps need to be taken, the Corps has done so.
Was there something more imposing than an electric barrier? I think that's what they're thinking, that isn't enough. And I'm just wondering if there would be something, may cost a lot of money, maybe the states would have to help pay for it.
The Corps is looking at other solutions, so-called bio-bullets, that would actually use technology targeted to Asian carp to kill them in the water without hurting other species, and at other solutions that would deter them.
Finish that.
No, Your Honor, please.
Oh, no, I just wondered, so do you intend to complete the DISCO barrier recommended by the interim 3A study?
I think what the Corps intends to do, I believe, Your Honor, is to work on a demonstration project using bubble curtains, strobe lights, and acoustic deterrents, and to do so down below the current electric barrier to test their efficacy where we know that there are Asian carp and to see how this works in practice.
And I'd like you to get to this request to expedite the study as well, because I want to understand, you know, are the same balancing factors in place and why can it be expedited?
Your Honor, General Peabody testified to that and explained that the GLMRS, to use its unlovely acronym, is an incredibly comprehensive effort to look at these two enormous basins, to look at every path through which invasive species might travel, not just Asian carp, not just the Chicago area waterway system, and to look at transmission of invasive species in both directions. That's an incredibly large effort. Now, the Corps understands that the Chicago area waterway system is of particular interest. That is its own subpart of GLMRIS. But to do this right, General Peabody testified, will take time. The 18-month time frame, which has been proposed by legislation in Congress but never adopted, but which the plaintiffs have proposed, General Peabody testified he did not think it could be efficaciously done, up to the standards necessary to support federal action.
Now, is GLMRIS the study that the Corps has said, though, that if it learns along the way of measures that would be effective, it'll implement them immediately, or is that more of these interim 2A, B, et cetera? I thought there was some representation that the Corps had made that it would phase in measures as they became known.
Both the efficacy study and GLMRIS have the capability to break out pieces as they become ready. Now, but GLMRIS, even looking at the Chicago area piece, it's a much larger piece, and I think it will be longer before anything could be broken out. I want to make one broader point about the idea of expediting. The plaintiffs have never suggested what the legal basis for expediting it would be, and the Supreme Court in Norton versus Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, footnote 1 in the accompanying text, explained that an APA action can't lie to compel agency action unreasonably delayed unless there is a mandatory duty to comply by a particular time frame. And if you look at the statute that initiated GLMRIS, which I think is 3067D, there is no time frame. When Congress wants to put a time frame on a core study, it knows how to do so. It has done so many times. There is no time frame here because Congress wants this to be comprehensive, to address the entire situation, and that is what the Corps and its partner agencies are doing.
So GLMRIS is going to look at this entire area around from Lake Superior all the way to Lake Ontario?
I believe
the entire Mississippi, Ohio, Missouri basin as it relates to the Great Lakes?
Interbasin transfers, at any point, the one basin can transfer to the other in either direction. That's correct, Your Honor.
So that includes zebra mussels and all that other stuff?
It does, Judge Mannion.
We're just looking at the carp.
That's true, but I think that highlights that the plaintiffs want to compel GLMRIS to be something that Congress didn't specify and that the agencies conducting it don't intend for it to be. And there is no basis in the federal common law of nuisance, there's no basis in the APA for a federal district court to compel the Corps to do that. And that's what the district court correctly recognized.
So as this study is going forward, let's say live Asian carp appear above the barrier. Would the Corps close the locks under that situation, or would it be too late at that point?
Well, Judge Williams, the Corps is constantly looking at what steps need to be taken. There has been one live Asian carp found above the barrier, the one big head carp that was caught in a netting operation. And the Corps...
I'm suggesting more than one, or if it appeared again during the time that this study was in progress, could the Corps and would the Corps cut it down, shut it down, close the locks?
I can't speak for whether the Corps would do that in the hypothetical that Your Honor is asking, precisely because it's a question of what does the science tell us, what numbers appear to be there. I mean, the experts who testified at the preliminary injunction hearing acknowledged that there probably were a few live Asian carp in the Chicago area waterway system, and that was the likely reading or likely import of the eDNA results. But at the same time, because of these extensive electrofishing, netting, rotenoning operations, they were able to testify that they did not think that it was more than a few. That's the finding that the district court credited, and that was a significant basis for it.
What steps is the Corps taking right now to monitor the areas, as you're calling it, I guess, above the electric barrier? Is it fishing? Is it, water samples for the eDNA? What are you doing?
The Corps does all of the Corps and its partner agencies do all of those things. The federal government has brought eDNA in-house so that it can do it itself rather than contracting.
You're not challenging the scientific reliability of eDNA anymore.
Well, the Corps used it as a useful tool to target these other efforts, but it is one tool in the toolbox, and precisely what the findings what inferences can be drawn from the findings, that was certainly a disputed issue at the PI hearing, and Judge Dow heard from the heard from Mr. Chapman, heard from Mr. Woolley, heard from the other side, and found as a fact that the inferences that the Corps had acted based upon were the reasonable ones.
Well, yeah, I mean, as I understand it, it's just not as robust an inference as maybe the states said, that you could have eDNA because of a dead fish or because of fecal matter or because of a live fish or because of a number of different things.
Right. eDNA can come from a number of places, and indeed the matter itself that generates the eDNA can have been brought there from somewhere else. And General Peabody testified that all those things are things that the Corps has to take into account when deciding what weight to place on eDNA results, and so that's why it goes out and it uses these extraordinary operations to confirm, you know, or refute or to see what's out there. And
so is there any kind of executive order or anything within the scope of this Asian Carp Regional Coordination Committee that imposes a duty on the Corps and the fellow agencies to take immediate measures if it turns out the carp are slipping through?
A duty? No. The Corps, however, does have the emergency authority that Your Honor alluded to earlier, Section 126, which allows the Secretary of the Army substantial discretion to take emergency action to combat the spread of Asian carp.
And that emergency action could include closing the locks indefinitely.
I'm not sure about indefinitely, Your Honor, because after Section 126 is, after all, a time-limited authority, and the Corps has to bear that in mind when making decisions, you know, that will have ramifications into the future. But the Corps, this is reflected in the Interim 3 report, understood that Section 126 did give it authority to close the locks for a period of time.
Yeah, and what's that time frame? Just remind me of that under 126.
Section 126 itself expires. Right now it expires on September 30th of this year. Congress could, of course, renew it or extend it. If the Court has no further questions for the government at this time, we would urge the Court to affirm.
Thank you very much. Mr. O'Connor?
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Brendan O'Connor, and I represent the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District of Greater Chicago. The District Court correctly denied a mandatory preliminary injunction seeking to prohibit two governmental agencies' normal and highly regulated operation of a regional waterway system as an alleged public nuisance, where the Court determined, one, that the alleged harm was remote, speculative, and being addressed by multi-agency efforts, and two, that the proposed injunctive relief would pose an increased likelihood of flooding to the entire Chicagoland region, would compromise the vital public safety functions of the police and fire departments in the cause and on the lake, and have a detrimental effect on the regional economy.
Now, Mr. Reichel said, though, that the states would accept an injunction that allowed for opening of the gates in extreme circumstances. It happens now and then, but it doesn't happen all the time. So on the idea that, you know, you do what you can do, why shouldn't we seriously consider this point that the locks should usually be closed and that the sluice gates should, in fact, all have this kind of screen that at least you've managed to put some up? I don't know whether that's your district. I mean, there's a fairly complicated relationship here between the Corps and the district, as I perceive it. But where's the public safety harm or the flooding harm if the injunction the states want is limited in this way?
Well, Your Honors, relative to the fact of what would be termed reversals to the lake when the flooding increase is severe and the district in its engineering expertise determines the need to reverse to the lake, those are situations which in and of themselves are emergency situations. We do not, you know, take lightly the need to reverse to the lake, I believe.
So you're saying usually the water is flowing away from the lake anyway as a result of the...
The sluice gates serve two functions. They serve on the flood control function. They allow for the district to reverse to the lake as needed to protect public health and safety. That would be like the July 2010 rain event, which we're all probably familiar with, where both the locks and the sluice gates had to be open at that point for flood control purposes. But given the fact that we only do it in limited circumstances doesn't make it any less important or severe. We only do it in severe instances. So in the event that, as the plaintiffs request, that we were to install screens, and I'll also point out that the screens that they're seeking in their request for relief are screens with raking mechanisms.
Right.
So this is a technology that the district is familiar with in its plant operations, but when it comes to public health and safety in emergency circumstances, there's no room for error. That's why we would submit to the court that this type of relief, especially in the context of a preliminary injunction, is inappropriate based, frankly, on cost as well as the amount of time that it would take to see whether or not we could implement this. As the physical structures of the sluice gates, especially at CRCW North and South in downtown Chicago, there's four at the north and four at the south. We have two screens on the sluice gates at CRCW South. Those were installed as a alteration to our standard operating procedures in order to address the Asian carp issue. To have screens in place with raking mechanisms, we do not literally have the physical footprint there to do that. It would require us to obtain property interests from other governmental entities. It would require feasibility studies. It would require modeling. We're talking years, and the reason we can't tell the court about the cost is because we frankly have no idea. I mean, it's open-ended as to the amount of years that it would take to plan for screens with raking mechanisms in such a way that we knew that they were not going to fail when needed to reverse to the lake.
Does this technology exist, or is it in place in any other part of the United States? Are there models elsewhere that you could study?
Relative to the unique situation for flood control in a system like the CAWS, the district is unaware of that. They're certainly used in plants for less emergency-based circumstances. Additionally, the district would take the position that relative to the relief requested by the plaintiffs, that we're actually incapable of performing much of it. The district does not have authority to apply rotenone fish poison to the CAWS for purposes of poisoning fish to look for Asian carp. Additionally, we don't have
You're just saying that you don't have that. Apparently, the Corps has that authority, but the district doesn't.
I believe that it might be in conjunction with the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. Also, the same with block nets. So much of the relief that they're requesting in the context of a mandatory preliminary injunction seeking the defendants to take affirmative relief, we believe, is outside the context of a preliminary injunction, and we would respectfully request that the district court or that the appellate court uphold the district court's opinion.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm not sure what we're doing with the time, but we'll hear from Mr. Reiser. We'll make sure that Mr. Reichel has plenty of time to respond.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you very much, Your Honor. I'll keep it brief because I know we're running short of time. My name is David Reiser, and I'm here on behalf of the Coalition to Save the Waterways, which is a coalition of most of the business trade associations. So I'm here to speak on behalf of the business community here. The point I'd like to make is that Judge Dow did not abuse his discretion in finding that the balance of harm favored the defendants here, and that the public interest would not be served by the issuance of the injunction that the states sought. As Mr. O'Connor and Mr. Jay have said, there are substantial concerns regarding flooding and the impact to the public health if the relief was granted. From our perspective, we're concerned about the impact to the business community. There is still a great deal of navigation. There's still a great deal of commercial business that needs those locks to stay in business, and we provided.
So I take it if the states were either at a preliminary level or at a permanent level, for that matter, to obtain the relief they're looking for, there would be a fairly vast diversion of barge traffic and the like from what is currently a waterway system to something, I guess, that would require offloading.
That's exactly right, and we had the testimony of Dr. Schwiebrun to talk about what those potential costs would be. And whether Chicago would still continue to serve as an intermodal hub if the cost of moving a material by barge rose so prohibitively that they could no longer move profitably up and down the Illinois waterway and through the Chicago waterway. So the costs, we believe, of closing the locks, even for a short period of time, were thoroughly documented. The costs of, especially during the course of the injunction, because this was in the context of preliminary injunction, the cost to the states was very uncertain. There was no testimony about when or if that $7 billion number that they were throwing about, when that would happen, when that would occur. There were a number of contingencies that would have to come into place for that to be an issue, and there was really no evidentiary support.
But, there. I understand what you're saying, but on the other hand, if you think of both the history of this particular species from the time it jumped out of its ponds down in the south and has slowly eaten its way up the Mississippi River system, or the zebra mussel story, I mean, there's just story after story of foreign invasive species having a profound ecological effect on a different area, in this instance a very huge and important area, the Great Lakes. And so on the one hand you've got commerce, and the other hand you've got, you know, the planet in a sense, our part of it. And it's a tough trade-off, and the district judge didn't spend too much time looking at it because he was so certain that there wasn't really imminence or a threat of harm, however you want to phrase it, I don't think.
Correct. Having decided that there was no imminent harm, having decided that there was no showing of potential harm, he addressed the issue of balancing as called for by the direction of this court. But on the other hand, the science, and it's very important to the business community as it is to this court, that the science be handled properly. The science of this was handled very thoroughly by Judge Dow. The original showing before Judge Dow, the original reports prepared by Dr. Lodge, showed that this invasion front that Judge Mannion talked about had stalled down by Starbrook or the Marseilles Pool, significantly below the area of the barriers, and that without the eDNA, there's really no evidence of fish being anywhere near, certainly a thriving invasion front, which would include populations that would include young of the year, being anywhere near the barriers.
So your point, I guess, is, if I can, you can tell me if this is wrong, is just that the evidence in this record suggests that things are moving at a pace that will allow for the full hearing on the merits in the district court, so that we don't need to jump in with preliminary relief. Obviously, the district court isn't finished with this case yet.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. And that's probably as good a place to stop as any.
Thank you very much.
Oh, sorry. Yes, of course.
I'm curious again. There's a lot of local commerce, the tourism, a lot of other things. I assume you represent all of this.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's correct.
I'm curious about the long haul from the Mississippi. Is that all barge traffic? And how significant is that as far as the avenue of commerce?
Well, it's a very significant avenue of commerce, and I think both the Dr. Moyer, who submitted an affidavit on behalf of the Corps, and Dr. Schwederman addressed the fact that barges come up the Mississippi bearing one group of products, and barges go down the Mississippi bearing a whole other group of products.
No Mississippi, but I'm talking about just coming into Chicago.
Well, coming into
Chicago.
Into the Chicago area, there's more than $16 billion of essentially of freight moving back and forth through these locks, through the two locks in front, the O'Brien and the Chicago Lock and Dam, and also the Lockport Lock and Dam.
Is this what we call barge traffic?
It's exactly right. And it includes a remarkable number of products, including aggregate, petroleum, chemical products, pellets for the steel mills in Indiana, the Port of Indiana. Also, we had testimony that the Port of Indiana identified their costs associated with the use of the O'Brien Lock and Dam. So there are significant commercial impacts should these locks be closed. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you very much. Mr. Reichel, how are we doing on time? So we'll give you, you wanted a full 5 minutes, so take your 5 minutes and we'll see where we are.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Not necessarily in order of importance, but let me just follow up with a brief response to Mr. Reeser's argument with respect to the economic impacts, as well as your questions earlier, Judge, about the magnitude of the costs involved. As the record reflects, there were multiple submissions by people who looked at some of the costs that would be associated with the elements of the injunctive relief that the states were seeking. I'm not going to summarize all of that, but Mr. Reeser has highlighted the testimony by Dr. Schwederman, who was retained by his clients. Again, there are different components of the cost, but if you look at the record, and we laid this out in our brief, although Dr. Schwederman came up with a figure of on the order of $4.7 billion over 20 years, if you break that down, and we encourage you to look carefully at the record on this, the much of that was based on the assumption that flooding would occur, and that built into that was the cost of essentially completing the TARP, the Tunnel and Reservoir Project, and other infrastructure things that are not necessarily implicated at this stage of the proceeding. And I don't want to spend too much more time on it, but interestingly, if you compare what Dr. Schwederman said about the specific transportation-related costs, that is, what costs would be incurred if, when locks are closed, at some point, traffic would shift modes. It would be offloaded to a rail car, a truck, or something like that. On that score, Dr. Schwederman's estimates were on the order of approximately $70 to $80 million per year. Not a trivial sum, but they happen to align fairly closely with estimates by the expert retained by the states, Dr. Taylor, whose declarations or affidavits are in the record. And again, it's important to recognize that that under the injunction, even the temporary injunction, the notion that all barge traffic and the waterway would cease is simply not supported. What would be entailed is that
the barge is going to move from the Mississippi to the lakes if the locks are permanently closed.
Well, let me say this. The barge traffic, a couple of things. The commercial navigation carrying cargo primarily goes through the O'Brien Lock and Dam. There's very little barge traffic that goes through the Chicago locks. What I'm saying is that
I thought much more went through Wilmette. I'm trying to remember which one it was. There was I understand downtown Chicago not so much, but
Judge Wood, I think the record reflects it's the O'Brien Lock and Dam, which is on the south side.
Right.
That is where most of the commercial cargo traffic goes. The point I wanted to make in this limited amount of time is simply this, that the traffic can continue. Cargos would have to be unloaded someplace other than where they currently are. But it's not as if, under this injunction, all commercial navigation in the water we would cease. Far from it.
And let me ask you, as this study is going on, and counsel indicated that, you know, if the situation changed or they realized that the Corps realized they had to react, that they could react, and they could, would you get notice of that? I'm just trying to figure out how broadly, you know, it's an interim report. They're working toward it, they get some indication that CARP have breached the barrier, and more than one CARP. I mean, would you,
okay, well,
you know, how would that process work? Would that be something internal within the Corps? Does 126 require any kind of regular reporting? I'm just trying to get a handle.
126 does not. I mean, I think
what
the
about the coordinating commission?
Yes,
clients are participating in that, I assume.
Yes, at least essentially in a sort of advisory capacity.
At the table, more or less.
Well, we have been invited. Our states were invited to participate, but
okay, that's what I want to know.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And so to answer your question very quickly, Judge Williams, the Corps and the committee periodically report the results of their monitoring efforts. But I think, let me go back to one of the truly essential issues here in that regard that was emphasized. It's, again, represented by the defendants that, and the district court found, in a clearly erroneous finding we submit, that's really critical to what we submit was the court's error in its assessment of the imminence of harm, that the expert testimony established that the Asian carp that are in the waterway, particularly those beyond or lakeward of the electrical barrier, are being adequately assessed and managed. And the premise of that is that they are relying upon this netting and electrofishing. And again, I'm not going to repeat what we said in our brief, but as we've detailed, the Corps' own experts whether it was Dr. Lodge, who was originally, was never retained by the plaintiff. Dr. Lodge was under a contract with the Corps of Engineers to do a risk assessment for this invasion. And he submitted a declaration, which was proffered by the United States in the U.S. Supreme Court in a related case, wherein Dr. Lodge explained in detail why and how he drew these inferences, and indicated even then, and more forcefully indicated at the hearing when he was no longer being touted as an expert by the United States, since his present opinions didn't align with their policy view, that Dr. Lodge testified there's a very urgent and imminent risk of invasion. And it critically, both he and the Corps' other expert on Asian carp, Mr. Chapman, repeatedly said that if you look at the science, this electrofishing and netting, while they are recognized techniques, you can catch these fish. Nobody disputes that you can catch Asian carp. Because of the limitations of these techniques and the particular characteristics of these species, they're very net-averse, that these techniques, even if intensively applied, and Dr. Lodge said this, as they're being intensively applied now, can only detect a very small percentage of the fish that are likely to be there. So we have a situation where today the defendants, the Corps in particular, are relying upon or trying to assure the states and the public and the district court that we have it well in hand. We're netting them. We're not catching them. Therefore, no worries. Well, the fact is the technology that they're using, based on the record in the district court, including their own experts, including Mr. Chapman, Mr. Chapman did not testify the populations are being adequately assessed or managed. And he was the only true expert on Asian carp that the federal government called.
So then your point is that even though you're at the table, the information that you're getting may not be accurate, has problems because of the process that's being used.
What we're saying, Your Honor, is that the methods being relied upon are inherently incapable of accurately assessing the risk and create a situation where there is, as we've explained in our brief, the evidence supports the conclusion that it is likely that unless other measures are taken to prevent additional fish from entering the lake, that if we wait until you can readily catch them or we see young of the year fish in the waterway, this threshold of establishment will already have occurred. And that is the harm we're seeking to avert. And that is the critical harm that needs to be addressed. Let me also now shift gears to the other prong of the preliminary injunction, both to address a question that you raised earlier, Judge Wood, that I didn't respond to. You had asked about this so-called glimmerous study, the regional study, and there are 18 other potential pathways. Let me be very clear about this. There are, as the Corps' papers reflect, concerned about the possibility that there may be other places where there be water connections between the Great Lakes and the basins.
In Minnesota, as I understand.
In Minnesota.
One in Lake Erie.
Well, it's critical for this purpose. I think the record clearly reflects that, and even Mr. Chapman, I believe, acknowledged this, that what we have in the Chicago area waterway is a direct shot, open water pathways, a continuous water channel, 5 points where it connects the Mississippi Basin to the Great Lakes. Now, there are possibilities in the state of Indiana where the headwaters of one river approach the headwaters of another, and in the event of a flood, some fish may... I'm not trying to downplay that, but the point that I want to emphasize is this, Your Honor, that it undoubtedly is true that undertaking this more global study would take more time. The states are not opposed to that study. The nature of the relief that we are seeking, and specifically sought in the district court and seek here, is to take that piece of this study that is looking at options, that is focused on the specific and most immediate threat, where the pathway is the clearest, focus on that, move that forward aggressively within a time period such that at the back end of this, proceeding in the district court, that we will not have lost so much time in trying to look at an option or a real-world option for a permanent solution that that time once lost can't be made up. The fact is, and we've laid out in our brief, the risk of invasion and establishment increases with each additional fish that enters. If this present condition is allowed to persist, where we're relying upon techniques to find the fish, and they're not likely to find them. If we wait until they become abundant, more time passes. And at the conclusion of the proceedings in the district court, we ask the court, assuming we can prevail, to fashion a remedy. More time, well, what's the remedy going to be? It obviously can't be implemented overnight. The government is embarked upon, albeit at an unjustifiably and unreasonably slow pace, to collect some information that could inform the formulation of a remedy. And as to the issue of legal authority for this, while it's true that Congress did not, in the statute that authorized this GLMRA study, establish a deadline, we submit that just as we've alleged in our primary complaint and with respect to the other prong of injunctive relief, we submit that the condition that exists today with this mounting threat of invasion and establishment in the Great Lakes of these harmful species constitutes, under these conditions, a public nuisance. And that the court...
Okay. And let me ask you just to wrap up here, because I have one request for the parties. My request for the parties is that the court would appreciate it if... we expect that sometime before the end of the term, the Supreme Court will hand down its decision in the American Electric Power Company against the State of Connecticut case, number 10-174 in the Supreme Court. And we would like the parties simultaneously within 14 days of the issuance of that opinion to submit a memorandum to this court telling us what effect, if any, that decision has on the questions before us.
Be happy to do that, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much. So if you would like one final sentence, I'll let you wrap up.
Your Honors, for the reasons that we've laid out in our briefs and alluded to some of the high points today, the plaintiff states respectfully request that this court reverse the order of the district court, denying in its entirety our motion for preliminary injunction. And we submit that particularly with respect to the second prong of the injunction, where the court didn't make any finding, but the record supports our request for relief, this court could itself, under its own rules, grant that relief. In any event, we submit that the district court order denying our motion should be reversed.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to all parties. We appreciate your help. We'll take the case under advisement.